Today is Friday, August 18th, 2023, and this is part 16 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Alan Malmquist. Alan spells his last name A-L-L-E-N. Sorry, his first name is Alan. His last name Malmquist, M-A-L-M-Q-U-I-S-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Alan. How are you today?
Good morning. We're fine.
Great.
Thanks.
Alan, may I have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. Alan, you mentioned you were talking yesterday about some really important interpretive work that you were doing on Lake Powell as a Park Service seasonal employee to help with dropping the fecal coliform pollution on the reservoir from visitors.
And right.
It's just a really important thing that you did there, and I just wanted to mention that as we start here. But I wanted to ask you about some hikes on the reservoir. You mentioned your area that you patrolled went up to the Escalante Arm. And I wondered if you had explored the hole-in-the-rock crossing area either side of the river there.
Yeah, I can describe that a great deal. We spent a lot of time there. And I'll apologize, but I'll have to skip back in time to start at the beginning.
Please do.
Of that, because I think it was from Gregory Crampton's history work that I learned about the hole in the rock, which was the last major wagon train sent officially by the Mormon Church from the Cedar City, Utah area to settle the Bluff, Ute area on the east side of the Colorado. I know really well that we went, Sharon and I and our son, who was just not much more than a baby, we loaded the camper on the pickup and drove out there, stopping and seeing the sites as we knew them from the books, that one of the early Hole in the Rock books.
This was on the...
Well, what year was it?
That would have been in 1977.
Okay, so on the west side...
On the west side
of Glen Canyon, okay.
Yeah, coming in from the town of Escalante.
Okay.
Down the Hole in the Rock Road, they call it. Very difficult to get to the end. It was, four-wheel drive. I hiked just 100 feet or so down and back, and really appreciated that and saw it as took a lot of pictures, and then, as I said, Sharon was asked to do an evening program for the park at Waweep Campground Amphitheater once a week of the summer on the centennial, which would have been 1980 was the centennial. And so we did several trips driving from the east and from the west to take as much pictures, because her program seems complicated, but it was really effective. She was on the stage in pioneer dress.
Oh, wow.
With a big pretend journal book, and she wrote up the program as if she was a pioneer on the trip.
Cool.
And we used quotations from all of the real pioneer women. In other words, what she described was the real thing.
Nice.
And I set up a slideshow that was projected behind her on the large screen.
Okay.
And it showed, I got all sorts of pictures of Utah in the 1880s, and with especially with wagon trains and family, and so I had black and white pictures of the supposedly being in the 1880s of all the places they went. And then in color, I have slides of the same places today.
Oh, wow.
It's worked out very effective because, I think I have been introduced her most of the time saying this is, the black and white pictures are historic. And at least Utah in the 1880s, and setting the tone and where they were going and why, and telling all about it. And then, of course, the whole focus was when the party got to the hole in the rock, it was so horrendous getting down there that it made a very exciting program, an exciting trip, and having pictures of the whole thing from the top of the rim down where there are remains of the old wagon road and down to the lake. And then we went and explored the eastern side.
Okay, Alan.
Somewhere.
Hey, Alan. I'm just going to kind of mention, I think, my understanding of the eastern side. This is a wedge of land bounded on the south by the San Juan River, bounded
right
on the north by the Colorado River and Glen Canyon, and it was a fascinatingly rugged landscape. Today,
right,
there's a lot of these amazing four-wheel drive vehicles that crawl over this kind of country, and people drive out there, but back in the 1970s,
yeah,
was anybody driving that thing still, or was it?
Oh, yeah.
They were, okay.
They were, yeah. With a Jeep and a good travel map, you could get out to the, and like you say, that wedge, that triangular area out there that's still basically, it is wilderness. It's flat up there, but you're working over very rugged areas and heading canyons and coming from both sides. The canyons are eating at that plateau, but you could get to the rim of the plateau, and then you could hike down the Hole in the Rock Road to the lake, and what is now the lake in Cottonwood Canyon.
Okay.
And you could also see across Lake Powell easily coming down from the east and see the Hole in the Rock itself, that cliff on the west side.
Right.
Because it's all a big fault line there that shifted
right
a little, and that's the only way, reason there was a wagon road down and a wagon road up the other side from cliff to cliff. But the other interesting thing was somehow, and I don't remember how it was initiated or who initiated, all I know is that the interpreter, the boss asked or told Sharon about that there's someone has got, or the park has, ready to mark the trail through the park from the lake east to the plateau. And it amounted to redwood 4x4 posts, and the top was cut off at an angle. And with a router, there was a design of the end of a covered wagon on it,
okay,
a little one. And then down the side of the post, it said, Holden the Rock Trail, routed into it. And these were probably 6-foot posts, so they'd be buried at least 2 feet. And they were ready to go up and install those. Well, it turned out, and I don't remember all the politics or whatever, but Sharon and I went. Another interpretive ranger, Alice Talaki.
Oh, she did.
It was the three of us. And she got one of the park's interpreter boats, which was a small cruiser, very small. And we stacked all the...
Yeah, a couple of young people.
Initially?
Yes.
Okay. Sharon says there could be a couple of young people that went along to help. There could have been...
It could have been high school seasonals.
There could have been like the high
okay.
school seasonals, the youth corps, whatever they have. But anyway, I remember vividly, we loaded these 12 or 14 4x4 posts into the bottom of a boat, and we got in it with our gear because we were going to camp overnight or two nights, and food and everything, and all of us, and started up lake, and the boat would not come on plane, which it was too heavy in the back, so it was just going down the lake with its bow sticking up, and no problem, except you'd never get up to
the cruising speed. I mean, did you tell Sharon and Alice to go climb out in the front of the boat and see if you can get the nose to come down?
We moved all the posts up as close as we could to the front, meaning that they were balanced on the center of the boat,
okay,
on the back.
Right.
And then the people sat either front or medium, wherever it balanced the boat. Part I remember is having to move all those darn poles. But that was our first real time with Alice, who's just a wonderful interpreter. She was local. She was Navajo and had been born and raised just south of Page up on the plateaus. And,
nice.
You know, worked her way to getting the summer jobs, and then in later years, full-time at the South Rim as an interpreter, and back at Glen Canyon as an interpreter. And her husband, was a Hopi, and they lived in Page at this time. But we went out, and we did put these poles sometimes 100 yards, maybe further. Every one of them, you should have been able to stand at that pole and look ahead and see the next pole.
Okay.
And we spread it out as much as we could, because there was probably 2 miles of trail there that we wanted to do. And we did that successfully. Dug and planted them all and really enjoyed the time up there.
Hey, Alan.
I'm amazed that they're still there.
Alan,
yeah.
That's a long way from Waweep, where I'm assuming you picked the boat up to go all the way up there. Did you stop for fuel at Dangling Rope? Was Dangling Rope even in operation, or did you go into Forbidding Canyon to get some fuel there?
we had to go into Forbidden Canyon. That's where it was.
Okay.
And I know I've been in there gassing up several times before it was moved to Dangling Ropes. So it was in there, and when we went up, there were, I would say back then very few people, but definitely no one up there in Cottonwood Canyon where we were. But that was my first introduction to Hole in the Rock, and a pretty in-depth one, because we went and hiked down from the top all the way and hiked up from the lake several times.
Nice.
And there was even a group that I don't remember right now, but it was a Mormon history genealogy group or something.
Okay.
That rented several houseboats and requested that we come along and guide whoever was able up the lower part of the, maybe we went all the way up and all the way down and spent the night on the houseboats. But it's a really wonderful place.
Mm.
And the history continues, because I can just add a couple things. The part that everyone describes and is amazed at, the way they, drove the wagons off the edge, sliding down this slot full of sand.
Right.
They didn't let them with ropes or take them apart or empty them or anything. It was the job for the horses and oxen to get out of the way. And a couple were injured, but they made it all the way down. But when they got to Bluff, immediately they had used all their supplies that they were going to, the seed and corn for the planting their crops and their food for the winter. And immediately, three or four wagons and the best teams, they turned around and went back from Bluff and went up the Hole in the Rock and back to Cedar City, got more supplies, came around and went down the thing again.
Wow.
And went across there. And the group that went up the Hole in the Rock, to me, is almost more impressive than the ones that came down.
That is really amazing.
Especially if you see it today.
Wow.
It's just very difficult to walk up and down.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Huh.
And then in the 1890s, there was, I mentioned before, the gold rush in Glen Canyon, and Hole in the Rock was one of the access points. The guy's name, his last name was Hall, who built the ferry down at the Hole in the Rock that got the wagons across.
That's Charles. That's Charles Hall.
Charles Hall. I forgot his name. He moved his ferry up kind of halfway to height and operated it there, because he could see that no one was going to want to do Hole in the Rock regularly. But it was still an access point, and there was a group of miners that came in there, and they first took down, got a whole bunch of huge logs and timbers up in the, above Escalante, hauled them all the way out there on the wagons, and let them off these beams off the cliff, and they actually, these miners were, it's either Nielsen or Nelson, I believe, was in charge of it. And at the river down there, they built a big barge and had a building on it and had a blacksmith shop and an amalgamator for all the gold they were going to get. And they were the ones that built the trail and the steps coming down through the slick rock that you see today. That's not the original hole in the rock trail. It's just they improved it so they could get up and down and get all their equipment in. And,
Was this a different dredge from the Stanton dredge, it was called?
Yeah, completely.
Completely different. Okay.
Yeah. Typically, there were probably 1,000 people that went into Glen Canyon and tried the mining. It was very unique in Western mining history because of isolation. First, typically everyone built a raft, either at height or Hall's Crossing or at the hole in the rock.
Okay.
And then you'd float down the Colorado and you'd stop at every gravel bar and sluice it. You
know? Right.
And the thing was, as you moved, you'd do what you could at that bar, and then you'd go downstream some more and find another place to stop and work for weeks or months, and everyone kind of moving downstream until you got to Lee's Ferry and you were done. It was a trip down the canyon and that was it. People went home.
Hmm.
And the other side to it that was kind of unique is most of the miners, it was worth their while. They went home with enough gold to do whatever they did it at home, especially in Utah, of buying a farm business. They weren't rich. They made more money than they would have, spent on it. So it was a positive one that way. There were no towns along the way, so that there was no one, preying on the miners, as you might say.
Right.
And they all, came out at Lee's Ferry, and then because they couldn't go down in the Grand Canyon, their rafts would be destroyed right away, and there wasn't any gold that they knew over there. The one raft that came down with that Nielsen made, and he got to Lee's Ferry. I'll just say it now because we're talking about it, but the log cabin at Lee's Ferry Lonely Dell Ranch,
mm-hmm.
that's really the neatest, most historic looking building there. And it's called Samantha's Cabin and has a history of its own, but that most of the logs on that came down the river by Nielsen. And if you look at the cabin, you can see the logs that were hand-hewn flat, and they're slanted at each end. And it was the size of the barge.
Huh.
And it's still there, but it's moved up to the Lonely Dell Ranch.
Oh, fascinating.
It is. It's amazing. But anyway, what do we want to discuss now?
Well, there's just a couple more questions about...
Pardon? Say it again.
Sorry, Sharon had mentioned something.
Oh, she was just saying she's going to the grocery store.
Okay, very good. Okay. Just thinking about a few more hikes up in that end... Can you speak a little bit about your explorations in the Escalante?
Yeah. And again, I think I mentioned one of our first times I talked with you, that one of the first, well, actually the second pack trip that I organized with pack horses and packers and equipment for the Sierra Club was down the Escalante. And that was in the early 70s when the area really wasn't visited much. The Sierra Club had explored, and not the National Geographic, I meant, that's what I meant to say, had done the exploration in that area, and so, you know, published lots of Kodachrome pictures of the highlights all through Escalante and Glen Canyon and all the wild canyons there. So, but there was very little publication there. And I had hiked it myself. And I knew in the 2 weeks we were there, on the layover days, I hiked all I could up the side canyons. We went down, one of the last main canyons on the west side of the Escalante, south of the highway there, and had a group of probably 20 people camping for the 2 weeks, and came out Coyote Gorge, which the lake was below that. It had occasionally been higher, but it was below that. And when I was photographing for Crampton, Gregory Crampton, I went in there 3 or 4 times by myself, hiking and taking pictures of the canyon.
Okay.
Mainly Coyote Gulch, because I really like that. And then in these days, I'm really amazed how many, you know, how much visitation and how much it's changed. Because at Coyote Gulch, where it joins the Escalante and there's the plateau very high looking down, now you drive out near to that and there's some crack you can hike through and come right down at the mouth of the Coyote, which was, you know, amazing to me. No one ever considered such a thing. And I had friends that came out, well, you knew Terry Gustafson.
Okay.
And his friends, but they were from the South Rim, the Matsons. He was a engineer for the Park Service.
Okay.
And he put in the first big water line across the canyon up there. And they lived in the South Rim. Matheson, it might be Bill or Matheson, one of them was Matheson. And they had 2 sons and his wife. I can picture, but I can't come up with your name right now. But 4 of us went several backpack trips, and one of them was down Coyote Gulch. And I remember it was in the spring, early spring, because there was a session about halfway down where we were hiking, you know, in our hiking boots or whatever, but shorts and the backpack and the parka, and it was just snowing to beat the band.
Oh my gosh.
And you're walking down this creek, and we turned up one of the side canyons we knew about where there was a huge alcove and sandy bottom, we went up in there and pitched camp and were just as comfortable as we could be and watching the snow cascade down over the mouth of this big alcove. And
wow.
I remember that vividly. So, but we went up all the side canyons and Coyote, and just really loved the place.
Hmm.
I just still love it. And so that's, you know, and I've kind of followed what's happened over the years in the different jurisdictions and the way, well, the public use has changed, and the town of Escalante changed radically. So it's a place I really have good memories of.
Nice. Your work with the park on the lake as an interpreter, checking in with people, making sure they were using their bathrooms. How did that draw to a close? Yeah, their porta potty, their portable toilets.
Yeah, it's very simple. In 2004, I'm trying to think whether it was spring or fall, but my lymphoma came back in force, and I spent the next, you know, couple months in chemo again, and that was kind of the end of that.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That became not the end of my stuff out on the lake, and others got the position, and I happily supported them, and it was time to move on.
Okay.
And I was, you know, there was no, I didn't have a choice because of...
Because of your health.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Health,
and then Joe Alston moved over to Grand Canyon to be the superintendent over there.
Yeah.
So you would have had a new superintendent come in.
Right. And I'm trying to think how I got, because what happens is that after I got better and rehabbed and everything was fine, I ended up at interpretation at Lee's Ferry. I really wanted that. I had my choice of, you know, any of the interpretive jobs at Wall Leap or any, and I chose down there because I really loved the history, loved the place, and just wanted, it drew me in there.
Oh, wow.
Say.
Okay.
And the thing is, it goes back to when I was at Pipe Springs back in the 60s. The history of Pipe Springs is tied directly to Lee's Ferry. I mean, it was a stop. All the wagon trains that went through stopped at Pipe Springs and got the water and continued east. The honeymoon trail that became popular of pioneers from northern Arizona east of Flagstaff and them all coming back to Utah would come north on the Pioneer Trail to Lee's Ferry, cross, come over the Kaibab to Pipe Springs and go west to the temple in St. George.
Got it.
So I was, the two histories went together. They were developed.
Interesting.
At the same time, same thing. The Mormon Church developed pipe strings and had a major impact on Lee's Ferry because they initiated and operated the first ferries there.
That reminds me, Alan, did you get a chance to meet Pat Riley?
Let me think. I met him quite a bit. I know the name, and I corresponded with him a lot after I was down doing research for the park on Lee's Ferry.
Okay.
And he came through there. I would say that I knew him quite well. And I, after he actually retired, and he published his book, and he would bring the cases of his book down to the visitor center at the Navajo Bridge and for sale, and we talked to him there and got a lot of information from his book and had a lot of newer information that supplemented his book, which he was very receptive to, and he actually put out second and third editions, I think.
Did you visit with him in Sun City, and his wife Susie? I don't know if you remember her.
I remember of her, but I don't. I remember I went to Salt Lake and went to the Historical Society out at the train depot looking for Lee's Ferry pictures.
Okay.
And I had the park, well, fortunately for the park and for me, Riley had basically sent all the historic pictures he had to the park, at least copies of them.
Okay.
And that was invaluable for it. So he was in and out, and I know I wrote to him in later years, texted him, emailed him, and then he finally passed. He was a good person.
Okay.
And, he was with Crampton. That was the thing.
Wait a minute. Are we confusing Pat Riley with Bud Russo?
Okay, there are two different guys. And I did have contact with both.
Okay.
At this point, I would confuse the...
Yeah. No worries, because... Events. Yeah, Pat's book didn't get published until after he'd passed away. But Bud Russo, his book came out, and he would have brought it to the bridge and in cases.
That's
and
who I'm talking about.
Okay, got it.
I'm glad you caught that, because... the two names were kind of interconnected.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
Okay.
I guess that, before I thought back why I was at Lee's Ferry and so important, when I left the Park Service in Pipe Springs in the 60s, I moved to Moccasin, which is the little Mormon town nearby.
Right.
And the Heatons and Johnsons lived there. And there was a little cabin that the Johnsons had built next door that his father had been in and his mother had been in. But anyway, Owen Johnson, who lived in Moccasin, and he let me live in the cottage next door because I was setting up pack trips with his son, David and Mel Beaton. But anyway, Owen Johnson's father was born and raised at Lee's Ferry in that log cabin that's at the ranch.
Okay.
And that was Carl Johnson. And Owen made very sure that I got the history of Lee's Ferry.
Nice.
Because when I was the park ranger at Pipe Spring, it was easy. Well, it's hard for me to. I learned that history, but Owen was the one who kept saying, you know, it continues on to Lee's Ferry, because at that time, John B. Lee was infamous, but the Johnson family's history there at Lee's Ferry was unknown. You know, and he was basically, he never came out and said, you need to learn about my grandpa. That was the end result.
But wasn't there a move? I mean, a lot of people would refer to the ferry as Johnson's Ferry. Because
definitely.
Johnson had been there for so long.
Right, right. He spent 18 years there as the ferryman.
Got it.
From the church, and had all these kids, and had a very involved history there. And the whole history of the ranch is him. I mean, through John D. Lee, came and built the first cabin and planted some crops and had a log ferry that he took one or two groups across. But then he was arrested and tried and executed, and was very infamous. And I guess his Lee's name stuck to the whole area.
Right.
And the Johnsons were there, you know, for years and years and years, and had a very interesting history. The other thing I'll say, just to close this out, is that my wife Sharon, when she arrived to Fredonia to teach high school, and that's where we met, there was no housing available there. Again, a small Mormon town that was built up around the sawmill from out at the Kayabab. But she got a home with Alan and Cleon Judd.
Oh, wow.
Alan Judd's father was also born and raised, or his mother was one of the Johnsons born and raised at Lee's Ferry. And Sharon talks about she had met me, we had talked about the Pipe Springs and that history, and after he got this book out of his library and said, here, Sharon, before you do anything else, you have to read this book.
Oh, wow.
And it was Juanita Bourque's The History of Mountain Meadows Massacre, which involved the Lees, you know, at the end of the story, Lee goes to Lee's Ferry and survives in hiding out there for several years, and then is arrested and executed and all of that. But Alan Judd wanted Sharon's to understand, you know, the facts. He wasn't hiding any of it. I mean, what John D. Lee did was horrible, monstrous.
Right.
And she passed the book to me immediately and said, Alan Judd gave this to me, and I think you're the one that needs to read this.
Oh, my gosh. Cool.
So, yeah. So I got, you know, indoctrinated, and I mean that in the best way, of this place over the mountain there. And it was a long time before we even drove over there and saw it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
To it all the time. So,
you know, Alan, I've got, we're a little late running today on this oral history. Can we put a comma here and then come back and pick this up again?
Right, because it's, you know, barely touched the years I spent at at Lee's Ferry.
Right, and I definitely want to explore that with you.
Yeah.
Okay, well, in that case, hang on a minute, and let's go ahead and conclude part 16 of Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Alan Malmquist. Today is Friday, August 18th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Alan, thank you so very much.
Thank you very much.